From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made this past October when the Cleveland Clinic released a list of 10 medical innovations most likely to be game changers. Number one on the list was using the microbiome to prevent, diagnose, and treat disease. Now, maybe you've heard the term microbiome in recent years, and if you're like me, you probably translate that simply to the gut. Of course, it's more complex than that, and this coming Tuesday, the Rochester Academy of Medicine is hosting an event titled The Microbiome, a Lifetime Overview in Health and Disease. So how can we create a healthier future by understanding the microbiome? What are the benefits of kind of doing our guts right? What is it exactly? I've got questions. I suspect you do too, and our guests this hour are going to try to provide some answers. And they include Dr. Kirsi Yarvinen-Seppo, who is the Chief of Pediatric Allergy and Immunology at Golisano Children's Hospital. Dr. Yarvinen-Seppo, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Antti Seppo is a Research Associate Professor in Pediatric Allergy and Immunology at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Dr. Seppo, welcome to you.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And Dr. Helena, I had it all down, doctor. Give me your last name.
Borsma.
Lots of vowels and lots of problems with the host. It's just one of those days. Dr. Borsma is the executive clinical director at the ranch at Bethel. It's great to have you.
Thank you very much for having me.
And I will probably mangle it again. I'm so sorry. Well, thank you. It's great to have you. We've got an event coming up on Tuesday. That's June 6th at the Rochester Academy of Medicine on East Avenue. So the reception at 6:30 and the lecture begins at 7:30. And you can get information on tickets by calling 271-1307. I just want to kind of start with what the microbiome is. And does anybody want to kind of jump in and start with just what it is? Antti, I guess they're all turning to you first. So let's kind of get a working definition of microbiome.
Microbiome, it's just all the microbes in any given location. It's not really limited to the gut. So it's mostly people talk about microbiome when they think about bacteria. And that's what it mostly is. But there's also viruses and fungi and all kinds of other boogers. But microbiome is not limited to the gut. So there's microbiome on your throat. There's microbiome in mother's milk. There's microbiome in that puddle on the street. So it's just all the microbes.
Okay. Does that work for you?
Absolutely.
Pretty good definition. Helena, you want to add to that as well?
Absolutely. I think he's absolutely correct. And I think, you know, on top of that, we have it on our skin. We have it on our clothes. I mean, it's just a part of our lives, every which way we turn.
So that's one of the reasons when we hear about newborns, the value of, and again, not to disparage C-sections, for example, but yeah. I guess from what I'm reading, this is just an example of where the microbiome comes into play. Less contact and less exposure and perhaps less benefit for a newborn in a C-section situation as compared to a vaginal birth. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So we know in C-section born children, the gut microbiome develops differently, particularly starts off differently. The microbiome originates in the hospital environment, whereas in vaginal birth, a lot of the microbes and the bugs come from mother's skin, vagina, and so forth.
And so that's also another reason for more skin contact right after birth, they talk about?
That also will contribute to the infant microbiome. So skin contact from mom will certainly provide a lot of different bacteria.
But again, I mean, I guess I'm just trying to get my head around. So that infant is kind of absorbing and then it's impacting their own? Is that right?
Absolutely. Okay. Anything that the infant is in close contact before birth, already in utero, amniotic fluid, for example, and placenta, they're not sterile either. So there are some bugs and bacteria that will start colonizing the infant microbiome in different locations, including the gut and skin. And as the infant is born, more exposure happens and more bacteria will start colonizing the infant.
So why is the Cleveland Clinic listing this as number one on a list of medical innovation game changers? Why is the microbiome getting so much attention? Is it because, are we getting better research on benefits? You know, why do you think, Helena, you want to start with that?
Sure. So the microbiome, what we're learning is that it's so diversified, that it's affecting us in so many different ways than we ever thought was previously possible. So when we think about it in terms of like you just mentioned, being born, you know, that sets up our microbiome for life, essentially. We start there at birth. So if we have vaginal birth, we're absorbing the microbiome from our mothers, we're absorbing it from the delivery room, anything in that initial environment. And then as we grow, and actually through the mother's milk too, so as we grow, we keep bringing more and more into the system and establishing it and colonizing it. So what we're finding is the impact that all this microbiome has on our mental health, on our physical health, its contributions to illness, its contributions to development. It's very, very diversified.
Okay. What do you think, Ati?
Well, the reason why its list is so high, I think, partly has to do with it, with the fact that it's very new. It's something that seems to have a contact in many different areas of human health. And so there's potential on it to find its way on diagnosed treatment and all kinds of conditions.
Where do you see its greatest potential?
Well, currently it's already well known and used in therapy of various gastrointestinal disorders. And that's where it's already in practical use. Mm-hmm. We work on the interaction of microbiome and food allergies, which I think is going to also be pretty significant.
Did you want to add to that before? I was going to ask about a lot this hour. Allergies, just one of them. But go ahead if you want to add to what Antu is saying.
Yeah, absolutely. We have already pilot studies. Not necessarily us, but you know, more globally, going on looking into the potential of preventing disease development as well as therapeutic interventions utilizing different approaches to modify microbiome.
All right, so let me just do this. Listeners, you got any questions at all? Balancing bacteria in your body, what that actually means, how you can know. You can call the program. You want to talk about food allergies. I'm sure someone will bring up probiotics, all those kinds of questions that always come up when we talk microbiome. Anything you want to go with there. It's 844-295-TALK, toll free, 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Dr. Antti Seppo brought up food allergies as just one example. So let's talk about the interaction of food allergies, microbiome, what we can understand. Let's start with kind of a broad view of what we know and what we're learning there.
Well, so in terms of food allergies, the things that people first sort of start talking about is that aren't they more common these days? When I was a kid, there didn't used to be all these other people with allergies. And so... So what would cause that? And one of the sort of fairly well established theories is this hygiene hypothesis, meaning that we are becoming more hygienic. We don't get sort of bacteria from the environment. We don't get our immune system doesn't get activated as much, and that's why. It's kind of like the immune system is sitting there doing nothing, and so then it comes up with this allergy thing. Mm-hmm. And so that's where microbiome and specifically the diversity of microbiome is something that we think plays a role.
We don't have enough diversity, is that right?
That's right. Right.
Okay, and so this is what goes back to, you know, the question that people have, is it really true that kids on farms have fewer allergies, that kind of thing, kids who grew up playing in the dirt?
Yeah.
And our guests are saying yes.
Absolutely. There are multiple studies over the last couple of decades coming, mostly from Europe, showing that farm kids have far less allergies, asthma, allergic disease, atopic diseases. We also know that there are geographic differences in gut microbiome development. And, for example, Amerindians have much more diverse microbiome, and they certainly are struggling less with deadly food allergies, for example. So there's good evidence showing that our microbiome has become less diverse.
All right, before I get to some of your phone calls, I want to just stay with this for a second, because if you want to raise kids who have diverse microbiomes, number one, good idea to get them outside, get them in the dirt.
Absolutely.
It's a good way to start, yes?
Absolutely. Because, again, the more diverse they can be, the better off they are. Because we're designed, right? As humans, we're designed to have this great diversity. We're designed to be in the outdoors. We're designed to be able to tolerate organisms from all areas of life.
Is it also diet, though, for kids?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Kids and adults probably, I guess.
Absolutely.
Right?
It's a very strong component. And you think about actually ingesting it, you know, the different fruits and the vegetables and the different meats. I mean, all of them carry different bacterias that end up interacting and working in harmony to help us stay balanced in our guts.
Okay.
We certainly know that the gut microbiome diversity develops significantly during the first 2 years of life.
Yes.
And by two to 3 years of life, the diversity has already developed. But that first 2 years of life is really the window of opportunity to diversify the gut microbiome and microbiome in general. And diet plays a significant role. We know that breastfeeding, for example, breastfed children have different microbiomes than formula fed do.
Okay, and those microbiomes for breastfed kids, for example, we'll see fewer allergies in those kids in life? Are there other benefits as well?
There are certainly other benefits as well of breastfeeding. The data showing that breastfed kids would have less allergies is controversial, in fact, at this point, but there's certainly lots of benefits of breastfeeding.
Okay.
There's lots of benefits. And I think it would also expand, you know, beyond kind of the medical illnesses and look at mental health. And that what we're seeing over the last few years is more and more research coming out looking at the connection between our microbiome and our own mental health, whether it's anxieties, ADHD, depression, and looking at the impact that those microbiomes have on our moods.
All right. So before your phone calls, one more question on the subject of balance. It's one thing to think about raising a child and how to make sure they've got a diverse microbiome at a young age. It's another as adults to say, you know, day to day, what am I doing to make sure that I'm sort of balanced in bacteria, balanced in the microbiome? And I don't know that you can test for this, but you can maybe sort of evaluate diet. I mean, Dr. Borsma, I'll start with you. How do you really answer that question for yourself?
Well, there's a couple ways. You can actually do some testing. You can do stool samples. You can see what kind of bacteria you have.
I'm sure in a clinical setting with specialists, yes?
You can actually do it online, too. There's a lot of organizations that'll do it with you. Absolutely.
Okay.
But again, it's one way to learn what your microbiome is and what's working for you and what's not working for you. But we also have to kind of keep in context that, how do I feel after I eat certain foods? How do I feel over the course of time? If I'm more stressed, how does my gut feel? Most of us know that I just ate such and such and I don't feel so good.
Fast food.
It could be, right? But I won't be harsh on any particular food item, because I think every food can have a place in our daily nutrition. I think what we have to think about is, how does that particular nutrition impact us? Am I able to process it in the way it's meant to be?
Okay.
So whether I have chips that probably don't have a lot of bacteria on them, and I balance that with a nice salad of some sort, we can see where the balance becomes important to the gut and how the gut is then able to help us with our moods. We have to think about a lot of the neurotransmitters, you know, that we use for balanced mental health. They come from the gut. They're established in the gut. I think about 90% of the serotonin we need is made in our guts. So if the gut doesn't have the proper bacteria to make the enzymes, to have all the connections happen, we can't possibly get enough of the serotonin we need. So then we could see affect and moods, whether it's anxieties and depression.
And when it comes to, you mentioned chips and lettuce, huge difference in amount of bacteria, huh?
A huge, huge. But again, they could both have quality nutrients in them. But what we're looking at is the bacteria balance.
Okay. Auntie, how do you view kind of creating a balanced microbiome?
So the microbiome in one's gut is what it is. It doesn't change all that much by putting in different bacteria. The balance is there as a sort of an ecological balance. So what you eat does change that balance, but it doesn't completely remove some bacterial species or put in new bacterial species. The ones that are there, and just what you eat changes that balance to some extent. I mean, there are therapeutic interventions where, you know, the technical term is fecal transplant. You can kind of imagine what it is actually. But that's where you try to, as a therapeutic intervention, change the composition. And the few sort of scientific experiments on that say that the microbiome has tendency to go back to what it used to be, even though you put in actual different species.
Right. And that, you know, and that's really an excellent point, because when we think about it in terms of eating a diet that might be more convenient to us than really what our bacteria is used to, then we can often see some of the upsets there.
I think this is the group of experts that should answer the question. Is it all just baloney that a juice cleanse will remove the toxins from your gut? And, you know, a three-day juice cleanse gets all the toxins out and your body kind of... I actually see laughter on the panel here. Is there laughter?
Well, I mean, I don't think it's completely baloney. It's a diet. It's not baloney. But it might sort of purge the microbiome. It doesn't remove toxins. That's just not what happens. But it does give the microbiome a new start.
Okay.
I think we have still a lot to learn about microbiome, gut microbiome particularly. But I'm coming back to where I started with, you know, the first couple of years of life is really the window of opportunity to diversify the gut microbiome. And there's some tendency after that perhaps sort of revert back to the state of balance that it created at some point. But there's a lot more information that is going to be coming out, looking at what is the right microbiome, what is health beneficial. Microbiome. Our own research program is looking at really the first couple of years of life and trying to see, as an example, how Rochester infants compare to, you know, farm kids and how the microbiome develops and ultimately what can be more beneficial.
Okay. And Dr. Borsma, juice cleanses? Toxin removal?
I'm going to go with my colleagues here. it's just another approach to, I think, mislead what's really going on within our systems. I think when we have the balance and we follow what our microbiome really needs, we don't need juice cleanses probably.
All right, let me get to some of your phone calls. I'm going to start with Pat in Rochester. Go ahead, Pat.
Hi, Evan. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I would like your panelists to talk about the effect of fluoride on the microbiome. My understanding of fluoride is it's quite a toxic element. It is in our drinking water, so we drink it and we also cook with it. It's supposedly in like 30% of our drugs. 30 to 40% of the insecticides have fluoride, so we end up eating it in some of the food that we eat. And I'm looking at three pictures. There's scanning electron microscopy of the intestinal mucosa. And one of them is a normal individual. The second one is an individual who's been drinking 1.2 milligrams per liter of fluoride in our water, which is equivalent to what we have here in Monroe County. And that shows less of the microvilli, which your panelists can describe as the surface area of the intestine. So there's less of that, and there's less mucosa exposed. And then the third picture is a person who's drinking water that's 3.2 milligrams per liter, and there's very little microvilli or mucosa exposed. So, you know, obviously fluoride has some effect on the microbiome in there. And I missed your first call, so I'd just like to say that fluoride and lead poisoning is why our kids aren't doing so well on their schoolwork. And we need to discuss the diet and the health and not just say they're stupid and lazy.
Okay.
So I'm really interested to see what your panel has to say about the effect of fluoride on our microbiome.
Thank you, Pat. Thanks for the phone call. Dr. Zeppo, anything you want to?
Well, I don't think there is a lot of knowledge out there specifically about fluoride and how that affects the composition of microbiome. You're correct in that fluoride at higher concentrations is toxic, and it's toxic for microbes as well. I don't really have in my head data about the fluoride and its amounts in sort of the stuff that we consume on a daily basis. So I can't really...
More research needed.
Research needed,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I would though agree with that, but the caller pointed out the difference that the fluoride consumption has in microvilli. Now we have to make a distinction here that we're really talking about microbiome that is colonizing the gut epithelium and is on top of the villi. The villi is a structure of the intestine itself. So if we're looking at an impact of a particular substance on microbiome, that certainly would not be seen in this kind of pictures that the caller is talking and referring to.
Okay. Let me get back to your phone calls. Jack in Pittsford. I lost you, Jack, but I'll ask the question that I think he was going to ask, and you can't have a microbiome conversation without somebody asking, is yogurt helping my gut? So,
yes.
Yeah, Dr. Yes. Borsma?
I would absolutely say yes. And again, what we're trying to do is that yogurt is full of different kinds of bacteria. And the idea is in the yogurt is that those bacteria know exactly what to do once they get into the gut, which other bacteria to work with, and how to help keep that colony well-balanced.
But yogurt's sort of a broad category there. Any kinds better than others?
Well, there are. Well, yes and no. I mean, part of what you have to look at is just that yogurt has a large variety of bacteria in it. And that's what we're looking at. We're looking at variety. Because as my colleagues have said, you know, based on where you're raised, where you're born, you're going to have different bacteria that have set up in your gut. And so knowing which ones you need specifically might be a little bit challenging to figure out. But knowing that you can have this diverse consumption makes a big difference. And so, yes, goat yogurt, extremely helpful.
Okay. Agree on that over here?
Yes. I mean, there's intense research going on regarding mm-hmm. probiotics, and a lot of the probiotics are the microbes that are in yogurt, and there's a connection to dairy industry there, in the good and the bad. But right. I don't think it's, like, exactly how that works isn't clear, and I just refer back to the fecal transplant experiment that when you put microbes in from one end, they don't necessarily end up coming out from the other end. Right. In other words, the human microbiome has its ways, and if you pour in some new microbes, they don't necessarily change all that much the composition.
Okay. Right. I want to let our listeners know, we've got some open lines now, 844-295-TALK. You've got questions about your health, particularly related to the microbiome, 844-295-8255. Or 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. Producer Megan Mack points out that, yes, you want to analyze your own microbiome, just as Dr. Borsma was saying. The Rochester Business Journal had a piece on this recently. You can have it analyzed for about $80 by companies like American Gut and Ubiome.
Absolutely.
And, you know, are they accurate? Are those tests accurate?
Well, they are accurate, but what do you do with that knowledge? That's the main question. It's just like sequencing your own genome. Yes, you can do it, but what do you do with the results?
I would not have any clue what to do with the results.
that's right. And to be honest with you, neither do I. But the thing is, you do have to provide them with the sample.
Yeah. Thank you for
that's
that
the
warning.
Dreaded part.
Yeah, we appreciate that. But we should expect, though, that the results are accurate. And then could you take them to, you know, a primary care physician and get anything out of this? Or where would you need to go with this to really understand it?
I don't think we know at an individual level at this point.
Okay.
Again, you know, so I think it's we're comparing different groups of patients, for example, or different geographic locations, but we can't really give advice on individual basis in terms of gut microbiome at this point.
On that subject, one of our callers, John in Brighton, wanted to know, if I have my microbiome analyzed, will it help my spring and fall allergies? Could it?
I would say answer pretty much the same. I mean, on an individual basis, I think it's difficult to give any advice at this point, although we know that gut microbiome is different in different disease states.
Right.
Okay. Well, let me get back to your phone calls after we get our only break of the hour. Let's do this. Let's get that break of the hour, and we're going to come back. Mary in Rochester, we'll get your call. We've got some others lined up. Listeners, if you want to call the program, it's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255. And want to remind you about an event coming up this coming Tuesday. That's June 6th at the Rochester Academy of Medicine on East Avenue. There's a reception at 6:30 and a lecture at 7:30 on the subject, The Microbiome, A Lifetime Overview in Health and Disease. $15 for general admission, $10 for members and student members. And you can jump online, raom.org. It's raom.org, or you can call 271-1307. Our guests are all talking about that. Dr. Helena Borsma is the Executive Clinical Director at the Ranch at Bethel. Dr. Antti Seppo is a Research Associate Professor in Pediatric Allergy Immunology at the University of Rochester Medical Center. And Dr. Kiersey Yarvinen Seppo is the Chief of Pediatric Allergy and Immunology at Golisano Children's Hospital. Your phone calls and questions when we come back. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections, Assemblyman Harry Bronson joins us, updating us on some of the initiatives he's been working on when it comes to jobs, opportunities, and more. Assemblyman Bronson first hour, then second hour, more candidates for Rochester City Council. It's our ongoing series of interviews with the candidates for City Council. There are a bunch of them this year. They're sharing their ideas on how they view the future of Rochester. Talk to you Friday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. To your phone calls we go. Mary in Rochester. Go ahead, Mary.
Hi. I was just wondering if any of the diagnosis or condition called small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, and if that is like a real thing, because it doesn't seem like the tests for it are super reliable. I was diagnosed with that. I was treated with antibiotics, which helped for a while, but if there's any dietary things that can be done, because I find the research is mostly in like the areas of holistic medicine and not necessarily in, you know, academia kind of medicine. So I'll take the response off the air, but just curious if they know anything about it.
All right, Mary, thank you.
Go ahead.
Anybody?
This is really, this is challenging. This is not my focus area, my expertise. Okay. So I would pass.
Okay.
So I
Dr.
mean, I
yeah.
so I think I would go to the space of thinking about, you know, when there's an imbalance in the gut, is to try to give the gut what it's really looking for, which is that balance, and trying to make sure that the nutrition that you consume is of diversified bacteria. So whether it's the fruits and the vegetables, it's different fermented foods. So if you look at from the pickles to the yogurts to the kefirs, all of those that have just a large assortment of bacteria, to see if there's a way to try and help the gut to heal itself. I mean, we're designed as humans to be healing. Our bodies often want to heal themselves. So trying to give our body access to the medicines that it wants. And oftentimes, food is an excellent medicine.
Okay. Back to your phone calls. Michael in Penfield next. Go ahead, Michael.
Hi there. I just wanted to know, I have three daughters who are eating gluten-free. Only one of them has been diagnosed with celiac disease. The other two just feel better when they eat gluten-free. Does that have anything to do with the microbiome?
Stay there, Michael. Go ahead. Yes, anybody want to jump in on that? Gluten-free, celiac. A lot of smiles once again here.
Well, we don't really know what the entity of gluten intolerance is besides or outside celiac disease. I mean, celiac disease, as is obvious from the caller, is a diagnosed condition where you typically need an endoscopy and biopsy to make the diagnosis. And in terms of what goes on with the people who have gluten intolerance, it's not very well understood what the pathomechanism is. So therefore, I would not be able to really answer whether gut microbiome plays a role in here either. But presumably, anything that we've been looking for, microbiome has been playing a role, so I wouldn't dispute that might be relevant here.
Yeah.
Good luck to you, Michael. Thank you for the phone call there. If you want to call the program, it's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Rita in Rochester says her daughter was diagnosed with Crohn's disease, and she was diagnosed in her 30s. Where might it have come from? Her parents didn't have it. So she sounds like she thinks it's a late diagnosis. Could that be, you know, related to microbiome?
Well, gut microbiome abnormalities and imbalances have been identified, particularly in inflammatory bowel disease, including Crohn's disease. So we do know that as a population, on a population level, if you take a group of people who have inflammatory bowel disease and those who don't, there are differences in the microbiome composition. Now, again, on an individual level and basis, it's difficult to pinpoint that in this particular situation, the gut microbiome might have played a role. But again, in a population basis, there are differences found between these groups of people.
And I think I would also add to it is to think about the factors that would possibly change the microbiome. So if we think about our own health, our stress levels, our anxiety levels, I think a lot of us can relate to, if we're nervous, we can get an upset stomach, or we can get diarrhea, or we can have some kind of change in how our guts are operating. So if we think about how many influences we have that are chronically changing how the gut is operating, those in and of themselves can certainly influence the overall health and balance of the microbiome.
Yeah, go ahead.
And we certainly know that there's an increase in prevalence of inflammatory bowel disease and autoimmune disease, as well as allergies. And we do believe that gut microbiome plays a role here. So certainly it can play some role, although there are other etiologic factors that have to play here. And genetics certainly are among those.
So if that's one of the factors that's playing a role, what can we do about it?
I think we need to understand, first of all, how microbiome is different, how it could be changed, and perhaps there can be some therapeutic interventions to change the gut microbiome composition. I think there's a lot more work that has to be done in this area yet at this point, and we're not quite there yet in terms of therapeutic potential.
Absolutely. And I think I would go back and kind of add to what she's saying, because I think she's right on target with that. And just to talk about, where's our stress levels? Where are our thoughts? Are we taking time for ourselves? And are we allowing our bodies to heal and to act and behave in the way that they were designed to? When we have long days, a lot of stress, different demands, really it's hard for the body to do what it's designed to do. So take a deep breath on that.
All right, let me get back to your phone calls. And Rick in Penfield next. Go ahead, Rick.
How are you guys doing today?
Good.
I'm a diagnosed celiac by biopsy, and because of that, it's been 17 or 18 years. I've done copious amounts of reading, and surprisingly, recently I read an articles related to how Monsanto, when they changed the genetic aspect of the wheat, how they shortened the stalk to increase the amount of wheat actually on the stem, and also lost the chaff off of the grain itself, is what caused many people, and it's causing many people to become, have this allergic response to it. Another aspect of that, too, is Roundup, which is a neurotoxin, which is put everywhere on our lawns, on our food. Apparently, it lasts 20 to 30 years in the soil. So I always question when somebody, as a farm, says, yes, we're organic, okay, well, what was in that prior to? I mean, you're not going to get rid of this stuff immediately. And it has to affect the microbes. There's no doubt in my mind. Even with changing my diet so extensively, I still have effects. It's very scary to me.
Rick, thanks for the phone call. Any thoughts from our panel on
that?
Well,
it is one of those big unknowns. What all things affect our microbiome? And you know, the caller is correct in that Roundup has a very long half-life in nature, so it's been used in agriculture for decades and it's probably still everywhere. It is by the mechanism of action of Roundup, it should not, but I don't know this for a fact, should not change microbiome too much. And the microbiome composition, you know, if you think about it, so sort of from a philosophical perspective, microbiome has evolved with us, the whole human race, for a long, long time. And it is what it is as a result of a very long sort of development beyond our lifetimes. How easy it is to change with sort of external factors, all these things, the changes, the increase in autoimmune diseases and other diseases that could have an impact by the microbiome are slow. So it is very hard to tell on an individual level what is the effect of microbiome. And what, if an environmental factor changes microbiome, how does that change your health? It is something that is just beyond the scope of the research that's still going on now.
Okay.
And certainly there are many factors that have changed in our lifestyle over the past 50 years or so. Most importantly, use of antibiotics, processed food, many, many things. Our diets are quite different. Use of automobiles, industry. I mean, there's many factors that play a role in this whole exposure and how microbiome develops. So it's going to be significantly difficult to tease out the individual components, but there's certainly, it is important work that needs to be done.
Okay, Rochester, this is Stacy next up on the phones. Go ahead, Stacy.
Hi. Can you tell me if there's any relationship between the microbiomes and acid reflux?
And acid reflux. Any thoughts on that?
I would say that the connection would be just the overall health of the intestinal system. Looking at what the connections are. I mean, if we don't have a healthy gut, we have a lot of different symptoms.
Okay.
There's the clear connection between Helicobacter pylori infection and acid reflux. That's pretty well known, and it's a condition that's being treated. Besides that, it is not that clear.
Okay. Stacey, good luck to you. And listeners, we got time for a few more questions before the end of the hour as we talk microbiome. 844-295-TALK, toll free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Sarah writes to the program and wants to know, she says, with a newborn, I keep hearing 4 months is young enough for solid foods, maybe 6 months. What does your panel recommend, especially when it comes to creating a healthy microbiome in a baby? She's asking, you know, when do we introduce solid foods?
So the AAP recommendation is to start introducing solid foods, first of all, when the infant is developmentally appropriate. So if they show interest in solid foods and they have the motor skills, then that's the right time to introduce it. But probably somewhere between 4 and 6 months is a good time. Now, this is, again, on an individual basis. Some children are ready sooner, others later. But that's a generally considered a good time to start introducing solid foods. Also, I mentioned earlier that breastfeeding does impact and formula feeding does impact the microbiome. We know, interestingly, that as long as the baby is getting any breast milk, whether it's together, you know, supplemented with formula or with some solid foods, until the very last drop of breast milk that is given, there is a sort of a fingerprint of breast milk microbiome in an infant gut, and that certainly could be beneficial. Our research program is particularly interested in looking at small infants and how their microbiome is developing, and this is a very interesting topic.
Can I just ask a really ignorant question then as a follow-up to that? You know, because you talk about developing that infant's microbiome and kind of tracking it. Is it a case where, you know, you're trying to create a foundation, a healthy foundation, a healthy microbiome from a young age, and if you don't do that early, you kind of never have it? Or, you know, it's hard to develop that throughout life as the child gets older, becomes
I honestly don't know. Okay. I think there is more work that needs to be done. And as I mentioned, the diversity on a population level develops by 2 to 3 years of age. So there seems to be a certain window of opportunity for the microbiome development, and how you know, fixed is it beyond that point? It's really not very well understood, but there's going to be more data coming out.
Okay.
And there's another aspect to this, which is that the significance of microbiome, especially in early life, is not necessarily just the microbiome itself, but how it interacts with the baby. So baby's immune system is what develops during the first year of life. And how that immune system develops is probably profoundly affected by the microbiome. And so while you might catch up with microbiome later in life, your immune system might have gotten an imprint during the first year of life of that particular microbiome that you had when you were really young.
So we know that breastfeeding has an advantage in this way. And then a diverse set of nutrients and food options that parents would introduce? Is that also?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. And currently it's really quite well understood that variety of foods should be introduced within the first year of life, as opposed to the previous guidelines and recommendations that were sort of, you know, delaying introduction of certain foods, especially in allergic families.
Peanuts, so, things like that.
Exactly. So we're kind of out of that now, and we're into more diversity and more diversity of different food items to be introduced during the first year of life.
Can we defeat peanut allergies, you know, in this way over time? Could it take a generation, but could we see a time when peanut allergies aren't so severe, or nut allergies aren't so severe?
Well, there certainly already is the landmark study that was done to introduce the idea of early introduction of peanuts between 4 and 7, 8, 9, 11 months, perhaps, that has a profound impact on decreasing the prevalence of peanut allergy. It certainly did not completely eradicate peanut allergy by this. So there is still some room for other interventions, and particularly gut microbiome could be one of those.
Okay. Let me get back to your phone calls. This is Amy in Rochester next. Go ahead, Amy.
Yes. So So I know you guys have said that you can't change the microbiome with a lasting effect necessarily with probiotics and fermented foods, but they probably still have some benefit. So my question is, you know, if you eat those fermented foods every day, does it help? But then also, if you take antibiotics, is there an opportunity to change your microbiome? Like if something wipes it out?
Thank
you,
Amy.
And then you repopulate it.
Well, nothing is absolute in this sense, and I'm pretty sure that if you eat probiotics, they will have an effect to your microbiome. What I was trying to say is that the amount of bacteria the probiotic bacteria that you put in your stomach doesn't, you know, flush out all the other stuff and become the predominant microbiome member in your. And it's the same thing with antibiotics. That much is known. If you take a course of antibiotics, your microbiome will change pretty profoundly, but it will return back to the same, or at least close to the same, in, you know, fairly quickly.
Right. And so, and I would be here to encourage you to have as diverse of nutritional plan as possible. I mean, you know, we were talking a little bit earlier about stress and worries and mental health diagnosis and all of those change. They just change our physiology. They change how we function in a balanced and healthy way. So when we have nutrition that's broad spectrum, that has all these different bacteria, that has all these different ways of supporting the microbiome, we don't know exactly which bacteria is helping and which one isn't. But what we do know is that when we have a broad spectrum, we have a better chance of catching the bacteria that can help us, that can mix with the bacteria that was set up as we were children and help us feel better.
So I from my auntie, I'm going to draw a very strange analogy, but, you know, for the men with male pattern baldness in this room, auntie, I'm looking at you, my brother, you and me, man.
Yes.
So, you know, there's this idea that, you know, your hairline is sort of baked into the cake genetically. But if you take something like minoxidil, you can fight that. The thing is, you have to do that every day. Otherwise, you go back to that. To what nature has set for your hairline. And it sounds like what Amy is asking is, you know, your microbiome may be largely fixed, but if you're taking probiotics and you do it every day, does that offer sort of a permanent and productive change?
Right. Well, that depends on what is the mechanism of action of microbiome. You know, like what you know. By the way, I would just buy a hat, you know, especially in the winter. You know, that helps a lot. I've noticed. Anyways,
so we'll see, Amy. It's interesting, and no one's probably ever compared probiotics to Rogaine. But there we go. We got a few more minutes. It's 844-295-TALK, toll free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. One of the themes this hour has just been on how much we're learning, but how much, you know, sort of we still have to learn to understand about the microbiome. So let me ask our guests, and I'll start with Auntie, you know, what's the most important research that's going on right now that's answering questions that we don't know the answers to on this?
I don't think I can pinpoint any particular one. I mean, scientifically speaking, I think the most important thing that we are working on, we as a community are working on, is learning besides who's there, meaning that the composition of the microbiome is what are they actually doing there. So the microbes are there, but what's happening there? Currently, most of the research is still focused on just counting things and looking at identities, and it's becoming clear that it's really not just their presence, but it's what's happening, what are they doing, what kinds of things are they putting out in the gut, and that's the interesting thing in the future.
How close are we to getting some answers?
We are getting some answers. Well, you know, it that kind of experiment, just budget wise, is about 10 times or 100 times as expensive, so it's going to be slower. You know, it's just a financial fact. But we are getting answers.
There's also some research that was looking at adult women and how they felt from an anxiety standpoint who ate yogurt. And, you know, it was a double blind. No one knew who had the yogurt and who had the yogurt-like substance. But they were able to report improvement in moods as a result of the bacteria. Again, which particular bacteria, don't know. And I think we're a long ways off from understanding that, but they are trying to isolate some of them. And they've got some animal studies that they've looked at, and they tried specific bacterias. And those bacteria have shown that some of the little mice that were in these research projects were a little bit braver, had a little bit more courage, took more chances than those that had some different bacteria in them. And so we are seeing that some of these researchers are really showing us that the impact that the bacteria is having on us and our impact and our moods.
Okay. And Dr. Yarvinen-Seppa, what for you is the answer to this question that, you know, what are the big answers that you think may be coming, or at least the interesting research going on in this field?
I think really really the next sort of step is really understanding what the metabolites are that these bacteria and the microbiome that they're producing in the gut. And not only that, but how do those metabolites impact the local immune system development in the gut and systemically, what's the impact? And this is a much, much harder question to answer than just simply who are the players in the gut.
You know, another exciting area coming out, if we look at the Microbiome Institute in Dublin, in Ireland, is that they're actually looking at trying to narrow down some of these specific bacterias to help with mental health. And they've dubbed the name psychobiotics. So trying to look at, instead of using some psychotropic medications, such as we might find like a Prozac or something in that category, is that they're trying to see if they can narrow down some of these bacterias. And eventually where they're looking to go is to make kind of a combination of bacterias that could potentially directly help different mental health diagnoses, calling them psychobiotics.
How realistic do you think that is?
I think it's very realistic. I think we're getting there. As my colleagues have pointed out, we're trying to understand, and as she was talking about, the actual mechanisms. But what we know is that enough research is showing us that we feel better when we have yogurt or when we have certain foods, and we're trying to look at that and figure out which bacteria that actually is.
And hopefully better, continually better, not like I feel better when I have a piece of chocolate cake and then I feel terrible.
Right. And it's a good point. It's an excellent point, actually, because there is a big difference. I mean, we all know how we feel when we eat certain foods and how we feel in the moment, how we feel 2 hours later, or how we feel the next day. But I think we're trying to bring the awareness and highlight that nutrition has these long-term impacts on us from a mental health standpoint.
Yeah, I think it was, good, Dr.
Yeah, and on the same point, the probiotics that are commonly, you know, available in commercial products at this point may not be the right probiotics. So really, that's the key to understand what's the impact of those when you really have characterized the right type of microbiome or right type of probiotics that could be utilized in intervention trials, whether for therapeutics or preventative approaches. And I think there's work that needs to be done, but really highlighting that the currently, you know, considered probiotics may not be what's really the key in giving people.
Okay. So to rephrase, what's easy is not necessarily what works.
Right.
All right, one more phone call. Wally in Rochester. Go ahead, Wally.
Hey, good afternoon. I love the topic. And I was curious about, as I'm warming up my soup for the afternoon, if putting it in the microwave is destroying those positive effects of the nutrients in the food at some level, if there's research on that.
Interesting question, Wally. Thank you very much. Enjoy your soup. Thanks for listening. What do we think about that? Microwaves, did they destroy bacteria?
They don't destroy, I don't think. And it's not the bacteria in the soup that matters. It's what you're in your gut, and then the soup is just food for them. So, and I think microwave actually destroys less of the nutrients than heating it on the stove. The only concern is that if you heat the soup in the Tupperware container versus the glass bowl, you get stuff from the plastic, the plasticizers that will change your microbiome, but also just directly affect you. So that might be the bigger concern.
Okay. When it comes though to that food, you said it's not necessarily what's in the soup, but didn't we say earlier this hour, if you eat lettuce, there's bacteria
Absolutely.
In the lettuce, right? So there are some foods where you're kind of bringing in bacteria from the actual food material itself. Yes, is that right?
Yeah, probably much more from fresh food that hasn't been cooked, because when you cook food, you probably kill a lot of the bacteria that are coming with it. And then when you put it in the fridge and you get some boogers growing there again, that's just whatever was in your freezer or fridge already.
Right. And it's an excellent point to why having a very diversified nutritional plan is incredibly important for all of us. It's just different parts. I mean, we get different nutrients out of cooked tomatoes than we do fresh tomatoes. They impact our body in different ways, and this is why diversity is important.
Okay, so real quick to finish the hour here, Dr. Boersma, what's the most exciting development you've seen in microbiome research?
So for me, as a clinician, the most exciting is looking at psychotropics and psychobiotics and really being able to see how nutrition can help us to look at mental health diagnosis. They're coming a long way with that. It's very interesting. A lot of the patients that I work with, as we change up their nutrition and we change up what they're eating, how they feel dramatically changes, and then ultimately they feel better with how they're living their lives.
And it sounds to me like for the people, everybody knows somebody who eats the same thing every day and has like a really regimented diet, maybe decently healthy, but healthy, or the individual food products are pretty healthy, but not eating a wide range. It sounds to me like the wider range we bring into our bodies, as long as it's decently healthy, is a smart idea. Is that a fair statement based on what we understand about microbiome?
I would say absolutely. Because we're designed for diversity, and the microbiome is very, very diverse.
All right, well, still so much to learn. And once again, if you want to attend this coming Tuesday, June 6th at the Rochester Academy of Medicine on East Avenue, they're having a reception at 6:30 and a lecture at 7:30 on the microbiome, a lifetime overview in health and disease. $15 general admission. You can register online, raom.org. Thanks to our guest, Dr. Helena Boersma. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Antti Seppo, great having you. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
I'm going to go get a hat. Thank you very much there, sir. And Dr. Kiersey Yarvin and Seppo, nice seeing you as well. Thank you for being here.
Good seeing you again.
All right, thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer, Megan Max, the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Hope you have a nice afternoon. Get out there with your kids, eat some dirt, or at least play in some dirt. And we'll talk to you Friday on member-supported public radio.